Blog Talk Radio.
That caught me today, and it was really quite a little bit of strange. Police in Michigan, police search cell phones during traffic stops. The Michigan police have a high-tech mobile forensic device that can be used to extract information from cell phones belonging to motorists stopped for motor traffic violations. The American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan last Wednesday demanded the state officials stop stonewalling the Freedom of Information request for information on the program. ACLU learned that the police had required the cell phone scanning devices and, in August 2008, filed an official request for records on the program, including logs of how devices were used. And the state police responded by saying they would provide the information only in return for a payment of $544,680. The ACLU found the charges outrageous. And law enforcement officers are known on occasion to encourage citizens to cooperate if they have nothing to hide. ACLU staff member Mark Francher wrote, "No less should we be expected of law enforcement, and the Michigan State Police should be willing to assuage the concern that these powerful extraction devices have been using illegally by honoring our request for cooperation and disclosure." A U.S. Department of Justice test of celebrity UFED used by Michigan police found their device could grab all of the photos and video off an iPhone within 1.5 minutes. The device works with 3,000 different phone models and can even defeat password protection. Completed extraction of existing hidden and deleted phone data, including call history, text messages, images, and geotags, a Cellebrite brochure explains regarding the device capabilities. The physical analyzer allows visualization of both existing and deleted locations on Google Earth, in addition to location information from GPS devices and image geotags can be mapped on Google Maps. And the ACLU is concerned that these powerful capabilities are being quietly used to bypass Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches. With certain exceptions that do not apply here, a search cannot occur without a warrant in which a judicial officer determines that there is possible cause to believe that the search will yield evidence of criminal activity, Bradshaw wrote. A device that allows immediate surreptitious intrusion into private data creates enormous risks that troopers will ignore these requirements to the detriment of the constitutional rights of persons whose cell phones are searched. The National ACLU is currently suing the Department of Homeland Security for its policy of warrantless wiretaps or electronic searches of laptops and cell phones belonging to people entering the country who are not suspected of committing any crime. So that's the newspaper.com. Check that one out. This war is in Gaza is so one-sided and so lopsided and so evil, you know, that I mean, what's happening there is just beyond the pale. Now the Israeli army is accused of using white phosphorus in latest attacks on Gaza. I mean, good Lord, white phosphorus. I mean, why are they using these kind of horrid chemicals, these horrid chemical weapons, you know? Just why? All right, why? There's no need for this. Inhab Kahil, head of the Justice Department's Medical Examiner Office in the Gaza Strip, has stated that examinations conducted by his office has unveiled evidence indicating that the Israeli army used white phosphorus and other internationally prohibited weapons in its latest operations in Gaza. Making his comments in a press statement released Monday, Kahil said that the bodies of Palestinians killed in the latest escalations were torn apart and charred to the extent that they were barely recognizable. Kahil added that his office was conducting tests to discover the instruments used by the occupation army in its operation on civilians, including weapons and chemical munitions forbidden under an international law. The Palestinian Ministry of Justice, according to Kahil, is in contract with committees responsible for documenting war crimes as well as Palestinians and international rights organizations. He hopes the reports issued by his office could be used to try the Israeli occupation for its crimes in the International Court of Justice. In this way, explained Kahil, it is of the utmost importance that the world is aware that the occupation forces persist in using internationally forbidden weaponry against Palestinian civilians. He called on the world to take a responsibility and protect civilians against the light of Israel's renewed threats of launching military operations on the Gaza Strip. In the aftermath of Operational Cast Lead, which claims the lives of 1,400 Palestinians, most of which were civilian, Israeli admitted using white phosphorus against civilian targets in the Strip. I mean, what the hell? And nobody cares. Nobody in the UN is saying anything about using these weapons. What, you know, against a defenseless group of people in Palestine? I mean, what is the insanity of this? You know, I mean, where do we get off doing this shit? It's like, I mean, I have had it really with the whole, to try to say that the United States has any kind of a compassionate or humanitarian side to it is a joke. For us to continue allowing these kind of things to happen, not only in Israel, but with Israel using it, but we're supplying those weapons to Israel, you know, to be used. These are illegal weapons. These should not be had by anybody, much less by a rogue nation like Israel. So it's like, come on. I mean, who's kidding who here? You know, it's in your face, folks. It's in your face. You know, you can't deny what's going on here. They're killing innocent people with the most wicked weapons, okay, ever amassed by any military, all right, and using it on defenseless freaking people in Palestine. I mean, why the brutality? I mean, they call the Nazis brutal. I mean, you know, we are tops as far as the Nazis go. Man. I mean, we just kill indiscriminately with the worst freaking bombs, and we give Israel the bombs to destroy, you know, the Palestinians. And, I mean, this is just absolutely freaking unbelievable. And something that, I don't know how people can tolerate this if they know. I mean, if they don't know, I understand they don't know. But, you know, to know about it, it's in everything, all the news, it's everywhere. You know, it's just wrong. Outright wrong. I just can't stand it. This is the Intercept blog. You can check this out. That's where I got this from. This is something quite frightening. Radiation exposure chart admits cancer radiotherapy delivers fatal dose to patients. Thanks to the Fukushima catastrophe, we've all been learning a lot about the laws of physics lately, especially about radiation. To help explain it, the folks over at informationisbeautiful.com have created a radiation explanation chart that shows the relative levels of harm from various doses of radiation. This is from naturalnews.com. The Information Beautiful website is pretty cool. The folks there specialize in making complex data virtually interesting. I've admired some of their work for quite some time, so I'm checking out their new radiation dosage chart, which explains all the effects of receiving radiation doses of various levels. The chart revealed things like 100 MSV annual dose at which increased lifetime cancer risk is evident, 250 MSV dose limited for U.S. radiation workers and life-saving operations, 1,000 MSV temporary radiation sickness, nausea, low blood count, or low blood count, but not fatal, and so on. as I read down the chart, things got really interesting. 2,000 MSVs, severe radiation poison. 4,000 MSVs, extremely severe, survival possible. 5,000 MSVs, extremely severe radiation, highly chance of fatality. 6,000 MSVs, usually fatal dose. 10,000 MSVs, fatal dose. And then right after on the chart, the very next line is a huge eye-opener because it said 20,000 MFGs, highly targeted dose in cancer radiotherapy. What the heck? How can that possibly be? I mean, we're delivering these doses of deadly doses to cancer patients, quickening their death. He says, wait a minute. He says, cancer radiotherapy, called dose is fatal. Okay, so wait a minute. A dose of 10,000 is fatal, yet the cancer industry issues twice that dose to threat cancer? I knew cancer radiation treatments were barbaric, but I never knew they were twice the amount considered absolutely fatal. This outcome is so intriguing that it took a screen capture of the chart. That's what you're seeing. Okay, I'm looking at it. Next day, I went back to the information in his beautiful website to make sure I really saw what I thought I saw. After all, if cancer radiotherapy is being given a 20,000 MSVs, that's pretty big story, especially in the light of the Fukushima fallout and the increasing radiation burden on populations everywhere. So I brought up the website, and guess what? 20,000 SMV cancer radio line had been removed from the chart. You can now see this for yourself, all right? And notice anything missing? The 20,000 MSV line has been removed. It now jumps from 10,000 to 30,000. Jokingly stated, it seems that the information in beautiful website might now appear to be the information is missing website. So, the cancer industry influence. How do you think this line about 20,000 MSVs and cancer radiation got removed? I suppose there are a number of possible explanations for it. One particularly conspiratorial explanation that someone from the cancer industry probably asked them to remove it. The cancer industry, after all, doesn't want people knowing that the simple truth that cancer radiotherapy involves a fatal dose of radiation. And no industry operates with more secrecy than the cancer industry, it seems. And all it covers up, and all of its cover-ups about the danger of chemotherapy and its continued suppression of truth about vitamin D and its cancer preventative effects. Then again, the Information is Beautiful website has actually done a fantastic job of producing information about vitamin D and sunlight exposure. This is precisely the kind of information the cancer industry doesn't want people to see. Pretty cool chart, eh? Just to give these folks a chance to explain all of this, I sent off an email to David at the Information is Beautiful website asking to clarify why they pulled the cancer radiation information off the radiation chart. Perhaps there's a complete innocent explanation for it, I thought, and I wanted to know the real story here. Well, the email I received in return was a polite response with a collection of frequently asked questions and answers. I don't blame the guy there for using this. They're probably incredibly busy these days, but I was intrigued by one of the answers in the email itself. It said that the Information Beautiful team has done commercial work for GE and BBC, Google, and many others. And who is GE? They are, of course, one of the world's top manufacturers of radiotherapy equipment. And who is GE? They are, of course, who can see an example of radiotherapy machines at radiologynews.com. GEHealthcare.c, I believe. But now we have the information pulling the cancer radiotherapy line out of their chart. They are a paid client of GE, top manufacturer of radiotherapy equipment. None of this proves anything, of course, but it probably raises a few eyebrows. Is there a financial conflict of interest to work here? Personally, I like their website a lot, and I'm a fan of their charts. So I don't want to think they are might be engaged in some sort of international censoring of their chart data just to protect the cancer industry. But I've seen stuff happen, stranger stuff happen. And he says, in this case, the information on that on the website is necessarily known for censoring the information. He's giving him a pat on the back and at the same time kicking him in the nuts. But, you know, I suggest you go to, it's kind of a long article. I think I covered, excuse me, I think I covered the gist of it. Oh, this is interesting. Mainstream media receives millions of taxpayer dollars via Obamacare slush funds. If you have to be convinced that Obamacare was not created with the best interest of average Americans in mind, consider the fact that the government health care has allotted $5 billion slush fund to be distributed specifically to companies, state, labor unions, and media outlets hand-selected by the Obama administration. And nearly $1.5 million from this fund have been given to both the Washington Post and CBS Corp to use for their early retirement programs. The early retiree reinsurance program is said to have been created by the purpose of helping participating employment-based plans cover a portion of the cost incurred by the employees who retire early. But based on how the money has been distributed thus far, the funds appear to be nothing more than a payoff slush fund that both rewards supporters of Obamacare with cash and encourages those in influential roles to continue support of the health care scheme. It is fine with me if they continue covering the Obama debate, but said Marsha Blackburn, Republican of Tennessee, concerning the new media receiving Obamacare payoffs. And the when the NBC News used to cover energy issues, they identified themselves as a subsidiary of General Electric. CBS and Washington Post just have to disclose that they are subsidiaries of the Obama administration. Interesting, though. So, yeah, nothing new there, I guess. BP's secret deep water blowout. This is by this article is written by Greg Balazs, and it's called the BP Secret Deepwater Blowout. Only 17 months before BP's Deepwater Horizon rig suffered a deadly blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, another BP deepwater oil platform also blew out. You've heard and seen much about the Gulf disaster that killed 11 BP workers. If you have not heard about the earlier blowout, it's because BP has kept the full story under wraps, nor did BP inform Congress of U.S. safety regulators, and BP, along with its oil industry partners, have preferred to keep it that way. The earlier blowout occurred in September 2008 on BP's Central Azeri platform in the Caspian Sea. As one memo marked Secret puts it, given the explosive potential, BP was quite fortunate to have been able to evacuate everyone safely and to prevent any gas ignition. The Caspian oil port platform was a spark away from exploding, but luck was with the 211 rig workers. It is eerily similar to Gulf catastrophe as it involved BP's controversial quick-set drilling cement. question will have to be asked. If BP had laid out the true and full facts of Congress and regulators about the earlier blowout, would those 11 Gulf workers be alive today and the Gulf Coast spared oil spills poisoned? The bigger question is, why is there no clear law to require disclosure? If you bump into another car on the Los Angeles freeway, you have to report it, but there seems no clear requirement on corporations to report a disaster in which knowledge of it could save lives. 5 months prior to the Deepwater Horizon explosion, BP's chief of exploration in the Gulf, David Rainey, testified before Congress against increased safety regulations of its deepwater drilling operation. And despite the company's knowledge of the Caspian blowout a year earlier, the oil company's man told the Senate Emergent Energy Committee that BP's methods are both safe and protected. Right, the environment. Okay, so anyway, just it's another typical crap. And Greg kind of touches on it. So check that out. BP's A Secret Deepwater Blowout on globalresearch.ca. IMF and World Bank create poverty. Okay. This might be interesting. So, Russian TV interview. And Andrew Gavin Marshall. We'll see what that's about.
Andrew Gavin Marshall with the Center for Research on Globalization joins me now from Montreal, Canada. Hey there, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The IMF, the World Bank, these created back in 1944, you know, kind of to finance reconstruction in Europe and to develop the Third World. But let's break down the evolution of what they've come to mean over the last half century. What's changed in terms of what they were supposed to be and what they've become?
Well, an important thing to keep in mind is that while they emerged out of the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference, the plans to create them were actually implemented earlier. And specifically in 1941 and 1942, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is an elite U.S. think tank, developed war plans during the war with the State Department to redesign the global political economy, create a new world order, in which America would be supreme. To do this, they came up with the idea of the two major institutions, which became the IMF and the World Bank. These would essentially manage the Third World, Latin America, Africa, Asia, for the benefit of U.S. and Western European corporations and banks.
But that's not the way it was sold. I mean, in some ways, it was sort of portrayed as, you know, these institutions looking out for the poor countries, coming in to help them. And you just said it's actually benefiting the wealthier countries.
Yeah, well, just as you have to judge a person by what they do as opposed to just what they say, so do they have to judge an institution on the same basis. Now, while the IMF and the World Bank say that they're interested in reducing poverty and development, all their actions have said otherwise. And the repercussions of their actions have exacerbated poverty created underdevelopment. You look at Africa and Latin America during the 60s, coming out of the colonial era, independence movements, these countries were developing quite rapidly. In Africa, the growth rates were extreme until the oil crises, which were, in fact, the oil price increases were supported by the U.S. State Department, and this created a flood of money through the Western banking corporations being loaned to these developing countries to finance industrialization. In 1979, when the U.S. Federal Reserve raised the interest rates so that they were 2% in the late 70s and 18% in the early 80s, all this money, all these loans, the interest rates dramatically increased, and this set off the 1980s debt crisis, which spread throughout Latin America, starting with Mexico and across Africa and Asia. This led to the World Bank and IMF coming to the scene to rescue these developing nations by making them restructure their economies.
And it seems, Andrew, they're not just restructuring their economies to try to pay back this debt. A lot of times they're restructuring the entire landscape of their country. I mean, you take these gorgeous rainforests in some of these third world countries, places where certainly a lot of things could come out of, and they're having to, you know, tear these down to build crops, to make money, to pay back their debt. What do you make of all this? And what do you make of the fact that, you know, the IMF and the World Bank have this meeting and they're talking about these policies and how to fix things when a lot of critics at least say they're the ones who caused this?
Absolutely, and they had a significant role in creating this crisis. They essentially act as neo-colonial institutions. Like you pointed out, they have to deconstruct rainforests and agriculture and focus on what's called export-induced growth. So producing, say, a cash crop. Like in Rwanda, they were forced to produce coffee for export because this was portrayed as something that would dramatically increase production, gave the country benefits, economic benefits, growth, etc. But if you look at the formal colonial era in Africa of European empires controlling the regions, it was done in the same way. They make countries produce certain crops for export to the European nations, and then thus making the countries dependent on the European nations for food and other services. So it creates a dependency. So the IMF and World Bank have essentially created this global dependency of the South, Africa, Asia, Latin America, on Western Europe and North America, which heavily subsidize their agricultural products for export. And in terms of today, they're trying to do how these institutions have changed today specifically, is that not only are they interested in continuing to manage the so-called developing world, but they're also trying to integrate and advance the process of global governance by bringing in emerging nations such as China and India and other nations into this institutional apparatus of global governance by bringing them to the game, essentially.
Andrew, let's talk about accountability here. I mean, again, these organizations, IMF, World Bank, meeting about policies, thinking ahead, trying to figure out what to change. The fact is, from what I understand at least, if you work for the World Bank, you're basically immune from any kind of legal action. Who are these organizations accountable to in terms of making sure that they actually are doing what they say they're going to do?
They're accountable to the interests that own them. And it's very simple to actually see who runs these institutions. If you take the World Bank historically, many of its presidents have always come from or been somehow related to Chase Manhattan Bank, which is now J.P. Morgan Chase. If you look at the second president of the World Bank, John J. McCloy, he was chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank. He was chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was chairman of the Ford Foundation, a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation. So the interests that run these institutions are very well represented in their actions. But from the rhetoric of serving the poor, you just have to sort of put that aside.
All right, Andrew Gavin Marshall from the Center for Research on Globalization joining us from Montreal, Canada.
That was interesting, I thought. Here's something we haven't really heard much about. Humanitarian regime change in the Ivory Coast. The former president of Ivory Coast, who refused to accept the results of the November election and continue to rule over the West African country, has been arrested after a military assault led by French and UN forces. The media portrayed the capture of Laurent Gbagbo, as a victory for democracy. Both sides have been guilty of violence and repression during the escalating conflict since the disputed vote. And Western governments didn't intervene on the side of the Gbagbo, rival, Ouattara, who sees justice done, but to safeguard the financial interest of the multinational corporations and ensure the continued dominance of France, Ivory Coast's former colonial ruler. Huh. Yeah, okay. That's why France and the UN forces were so eager to topple the new regime. Anyway, violence against Libya civilians exaggerated, says British group. In other circumstances, they could have been a group of British package tourists clad in identical T-shirts, clamoring on and off buses with cameras hanging around their necks. But Libya has no tourists now, let alone the package variety, and the 13 Britons who toured the west of the country over 8 days had a self-declared mission to find facts about the situation in Gaddafi-controlled Libya, to counter what they described as the manipulation and distortion of the Western media. The group calling itself British Civilians for Peace in Libya had found each other through word of mouth and the internet. They were, they said, academics, lawyers, a doctor, humanitarian campaigners, and independent journalists, collectively outraged about the attack on Libyan government forces by the biggest military force in the world, NATO. For some, it was their first visit to Libya. Delegation leader David Roberts, 55, from Leicester, said he had been several times before. Dave Roberts from Lycia is quoted in a web report as addressing a youth conference in Tripoli in 1999, ending his speech with a rousing cry of "Long live Muammar Gaddafi." Okay. At a press conference at the Rixos Hotel in Tripoli before the group left for the Tunisian border, Roberts and his colleagues set out their interim conclusions. So, I don't know. This goes on a bit, but they felt that the violence that Gaddafi was committing was basically pretty low. But that's questionable, too, since the other guy was a Gaddafi supporter, one of them. So anyway, I'm going to take a break here for just a second.
Well, I've been listening to your show from the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've crossed over a few areas, and it's been nice listening to you.
Oh, thanks, George. Yeah, no, I keep trying to be relevant, you know what I mean? Trying to stay relevant here as much as we can. Try to catch up on the news.
And
but,
what is that?
What's that?
And what is that?
What, the news?
The keeping up with the news, and what are you keeping up with?
Well, I'm trying to figure out what's going on. Like, there's, you know, the article I read about them using phosphorus and white phosphorus in Gaza. Oh, here's one I think you'll enjoy. Origins and techniques of the Monarch mind control. What do you think of that one? Monarch programming is a method of mind control used by numerous organizations for covert purposes. It is a continuation of Project MKUltra, a mind control program developed by the CIA and tested on the military and civilians. The methods are astonishingly sadistic. Its entire purpose is to traumatize the victim, and the expected results are horrifying. The creation of a mind control slave who can be triggered at any time to perform any action required by the handler. While mass media ignores this issue, over 2 million Americans have gone through the horrors of this program. This article looks at the origins of the Monarch programming and some of its methods and symbolism. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, but let's take this back maybe 50 years.
I'm wondering,
where does Walt Disney come into the picture?
What?
Walt Disney.
I haven't gotten to Walt Disney yet.
Think about that.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking about it. I'm just trying to follow this thread here. But the origins, it says, through the course of history, several accounts have been recorded describing rituals and practices resembling mind control. One of the earliest writings giving reference to the use of occultism to manipulate the mind can be found in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. It is a compilation of rituals heavily studied by today's secret societies, which describes methods of torture and intimidation to create trauma. The use of portions of drugs and the drugs and casting of spells, or hypnotism, ultimately resulting in the total enslavement of the initiate. Other events ascribed to the black magic, sorcery, and demon possession, where the victim is animated by an outside force, are also ancestors of monarch programming.
Okay.
Have you heard about this?
No, but I could see it in action, see it in motion.
Because yeah, I know you're very familiar with the MKUltra and stuff, but
sure,
this monarch program is
also,
granddaddy, I guess, of it.
Yeah, you know, the different paradigms that are produced, you know, even with Walt Disney in his animating, you know, whatever reality he wanted to put together. And, he was able to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like there's one thing that's been passed down from one generation to another. I think the morals that were taught with Bambi, you know, if you can't say anything nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. But, you know, it's these cliches. All right.
I want to get back on this topic, though, George. It's pretty gruesome stuff. I'm going to refer people to it because it's pretty, I don't really want to get into it. It gets pretty gruesome how this thing really works. And,
scary, I really do.
Secret
really
Arcana.
Is.
You can go to it. It's Secret Arcana. And check that out. Mind control. Monarch mind control. And, I don't know. New definers. Truth about the Council on Foreign Relations. Oh, all right. This is you want to sit back and relax there, George? I'm going to play this little short video about the Council on Foreign Relations.
Good. I'm getting another cup of coffee. Go ahead.
There you go.
The year is 1947. 1917, and Representative Oscar Calloway enters a disturbing statement into the U.S. Congressional record. The statement reveals why J.P. Morgan interests hired 12 high-ranking news managers. The 12 were asked to determine the most influential newspapers in America. They were to figure out how many news organizations it would take to control generally the policy of the daily press of the United States. The 12 found it was only necessary to purchase the control of 25 of the greatest papers. An agreement was reached. The policy of the papers was bought, and an editor was placed at each paper to ensure that all published information was in keeping with the new policy. Soon, that policy would be defined by a front group formed by J.P. Morgan and his colleagues. In fact, Morgan's personal attorney was founding president of the organization, the Council on Foreign Relations. Today, the CFR maintains that its goal is to increase America's understanding of the world. However, the actual objective of this highly exclusive club is revealed by the rare admissions of the insiders themselves. In the early 60s, a Georgetown University professor collects information for a book favorable to the network of powerful men who founded the CFR. For 2 years, Professor Carol Quigley is allowed to examine the confidential papers and secret records of this network. Quigley reveals that these men aim to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. In short, they seek total and quiet control of the entire world. And the CFR is their most visible conduit for carrying out that agenda. CFR members include America's wealthiest tycoons, as well as the highly placed elite in government, academic institutions, tax-exempt foundations, and the establishment media. Ruling Class Journalists, written by Richard Harwood, describes the CFR membership as the ruling establishment in the United States. The Washington Post article boasted that news reporters who are CFR members do not merely analyze and interpret foreign policy for the United States. They help make it. Who are these policymakers? Many of their faces are familiar. NBC's Tom Brokaw, CBS's Dan Rather, ABC's Barbara Walters, Jim Lehrer, PBS, William F. Buckley of National Review, media mogul Rupert Murdoch, owner of the giant multifaceted News Corporation. These media heavyweights, and many others like them, are members of the CFR. Powerful corporations are also invited to become members. At the close of the 20th century, CFR influence presided over far-reaching consolidations of media control. In 1995, CFR members Michael Eisner of Disney and ABC's Thomas Murphy merged their media empires. Soon after the merger, the Disney-ABC empire becomes a CFR corporate member. In the year 2000, the world's largest internet service provider, America Online, joins forces with Time Warner, one of the world's largest news organizations. The CEOs favoring the move are CNN's Thomas Johnson and Time Warner's Gerald Levin, both CFR members. Once again, another media giant is created under the shadow of CFR influence. Today, an elite handful of individuals define the agendas that are supported by the empire of establishment news.
George was right about Disney. You still with us, George?
Yeah, I still hear him.
You were right about it. Did you hear any part of that that video?
I'm sorry. I only caught the last 40 seconds of it.
Well, you know what's amazing is they were talking about this corporation of the media moguls from the CFR's involvement with the media.
Yes.
In that segment, they were talking about Disney's merging with Time Warner, I guess, and all these others that under another huge company, you know, media company that encompasses all of them now. You know what I mean? So it's even more censored than before.
Well, if you ask me, it's one big illusion, and. You know, Walt Disney is just one big industry that their whole business is illusions and creating these illusions and money profiting them. You know, this is the way business is. You know, capitalism is making money.
Yeah, they can say anything and you wind up believing it because it's the only thing that's being said, you know.
That's true. That's true.
Really sucks. And that's why I insist on doing these shows every week, two nights a week anyway, where we talk about, we try to bring current news to people, or stuff people haven't heard of, or, you know, stuff that, you know, people aren't normally attuned to seeing, you know. And at least for 1 hour a night, they can get some kind of, new news, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's the same old rehash and rehash of nothing.
Every station is the same damn thing, and they're all talking about nothing, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's the way they got you running. They think you're getting news, when in reality you're getting nothing, you know?
Right,
it's sick. They'll spend 15 minutes on a dog story, you know, and skip off Iraq and Iran and every other thing, you know? Just aggravating as hell, George. Yeah, I remember Alex Jones once said on my show. He says I'm sitting there at the Alamo. He said I'm like sitting there at the Alamo, and with an old musket, you know, trying to get the word out and trying to make people wake up. And I had to laugh when he said that because I felt the same way. You know, we're all. Guys with muskets, you know, looking down the throat of a 50 caliber machine gun, you know,
a
stealth bomber. But basically, that's all we got to fight with. And thank God we got something to fight with.
We have our brains to fight with too, and we know we know a good fight when we see one. But after a while, you know, you see that you're on the losing end. And it's not worth it. And I think that's where we are as a culture. We've had enough. And it's not that we've been beaten enough. It's just that we have no more to give. And it just so happens that the system that we're locked into, it drains us of everything. But this is just my own view. And, you know, politics is a nasty business, and to try to follow them and make sense out of it, it would drive me crazy. And I sleep good at night, and I don't get involved with these things as much as I'd like to, I don't know, Leo. You tell me.
It used to bother me much more than it does now, only because I try to. There's so much of it, and there's. It's almost impossible to stop, and it's just amazing that it gets reported at all, you know. But I give a lot of credit to those guys that are out there, they're really out there trying to get information, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
To keep them honest at all, you know. So.
Well, I got faith in the humanity, I really do, and I think right now. Everything is being exposed for what it is. And, you know, your true colors, whoever and whatever you are, will show themselves. And I think it's the fruit of your labors will be exposed. And so,
I think
we are under some unique times here. We really are. Where, you know, we questioned not only our own ability, but the ability of everybody else around us. And I don't know, Leo. I find it a time of pleasure because I can sit back and just watch the world go round and round and not be caught up in half of it because, you know, I'm in a situation where I can, but it's crazy out there. It really is. And it's something, you know, that doesn't change. Or it hasn't changed. And I got to look at Mother Nature. What do you think?
Oh, I don't. I just look at what's going on now. I'm looking at this article. It said Libya depleted uranium pollution to last over 1 billion years. All right? Hey, the bombs that we've thrown on, the bombs and the ammunition that we're using is depleted uranium, which is banned from, you know, international treaties. All right? Mm-hmm. And but yet we're still using these depleted uranium bombs and things, and attacking the Middle East with this shit, and it's killing them, and it's going to kill them for a billion years. I mean, it's going to, you know, it's causing incredible problems in Iraq and Afghanistan, where, you know, they've got the highest not mortality, but deformity rates in the world, all right, because of this, because of the radiation, you know, the same with now they've done it in Libya. You know, they just dumped billions of bombs or billions of tons of depleted uranium bombs and ammunition.
Yeah, well, let's back up the bus here for a minute. First of all, Leo, and understand that the people who initially fired those weapons with those atomics into, you know, the projectiles, they were exposed to this stuff also.
I know.
So,
that's the craziest part.
There are other victims of this weaponry that they don't talk about.
You know, it's absurd, and you know they're you know it's terrible. It's just terrible what's happening, George. And you know the soldiers don't even realize that they're dying because of their own ammunition. All right. It's just, what the hell are they doing? Why are they doing this?
They do know what's causing it, but I think in reacting to complain about it is a different story. And you know, we can go back, the last generation with the Vietnam War with Agent Orange, and it was only after years and years that they acknowledged it. But, it's going to take many years for us to know the truth about what you're saying. Yes.
We already know the truth, George. The truth is it's out there already, and we know it. It's just a matter of people, making it happen. I mean, if they dropped, if they started throwing uranium bombs around here, I think that the Americans would be a little pissed off. But since we're just dumping them, all of our nuclear waste over there in the form of depleted uranium, all right, who cares, right?
Well, get sidetracked, Leo. Let's go right to Japan.
That's what
right
it's all
now.
About, though. That's what's exactly what depleted uranium bullets are. They're radioactive from spent nuclear reactors. So it's like, absolutely insane. But
well,
anyway, George.
So take a look at the fallout that we have right now going on. And, there's not that much talk about this or about, the oil that went into the Gulf a couple of years ago. But these are major things that are going on in the environment. And, there's a lot of things that we're going to have to incorporate into our lifestyle changes, because of these events.
George, I got to take the last word here. We're going to be losing our stream in about 10 seconds. So I want to thank everybody who's joined us tonight. And, check us out tomorrow when we have when we go into the fourth dimension and have some fun there. Good night. And George,
yeah,
still with us?
Yeah, still here, Leo.
Yeah. We just lost our stream. I just wanted to. So we're not on live now. We're just being recorded. So, So I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I had to do that. I forgot what you were talking about. What were we talking about?
Well,
George.
Yeah. I don't know. I lost the thought myself.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
You know, it's. The environment right now is so polluted, Leo, and
yeah.
Understand that this thing in Japan, we haven't heard anything yet, and it's going to raise a few eyebrows, and it's going to change our lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, on that note, George, I think I'm going to call it a night, but I think you're always right on, always welcome too. So. Yeah, thanks, and talk to you soon.
All right, I'll get back to you later, my friend.
All right, buddy. Good night. And we are at the end of the story.